Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am Carolyn Yeager, live on Monday, August 8th. Last week, I made a statement about a 2010 Gordon Duff article having been removed from his archives on Veterans Today, and I said if I was mistaken, I hoped someone would let me know. Well, someone did. And it turns out that the article was given the wrong date by Jeff Blankfort. He said it was on September 24th instead of the actual date of September 20th. So I didn't see it there. Since the search engine on VT doesn't work very well, it was hard enough just to find the September 24th articles, and I didn't look around in that vicinity to see if there was a different date. I didn't have to make this correction on air, as most listeners probably didn't check it out and have no idea. But I'm an honorable person, and I also myself if I discover I am wrong. That, of course, doesn't take away from any of the other damning things that were said about Duff on the program. Tonight, I have a number of Holocaust items to cover. I'm going to ask the question, what is the state of Holocaust revisionism these days? I would say that holo-officialdom, the kingpins of enforcing the 6 million extermination story, are seriously launching a new coordinated, many-pronged attack on what they term Holocaust denial. Since they have control of all media outlets, all organs of communication, and just about all governments in the world, really, except they don't have the internet totally locked up, and our communication networks like VOR, but they are able to reach millions. However, perhaps their message is getting a little old and tired. Speaking of Voice of Reason Network, if you have come to the website today, you'll be greeted with Mike Connor's new and very attractive makeover of our site. He is not done yet, he says, but he's never done. The work is ongoing. I think you'll find that this is a more user-friendly design. For example, today I was listening to classical music in the background for a while, which I have never really listened to the VOR feed that goes on all the time, even though I know it does, but I forget. And now it's more visible, and I clicked it on, and that was very nice. And it also tells you what's coming up next. So I like that. I hope it will encourage you to contribute what you can to our efforts here. Efforts to bring alternative right-wing political and cultural viewpoints that are stimulating and responsible. So please donate. The latest London riot is in the news now. Lots of terrible pictures. And now it's grown to riots. I just read that it has spread to Birmingham and Liverpool. The Labour government is most responsible for this state of affairs, for their policies over the many years that they were in power. The news stories by this official news media that I mentioned already describe the London neighborhood that this originally took place in, the original riot the other day, as in a disadvantaged neighborhood. You know, everything I've read uses that word, disadvantaged. But according to the photos that are now coming up on alternative sites, which I saw quite a lot of them that somebody sent out, a better word would be black. It would read white if that were the case, if it was a white neighborhood. But we don't ever see the word black, but it looked to me like the people are mostly black. Also, they're truly concerned only because, I mean, the authorities seem to be truly concerned, because this neighborhood, Nottingham, is just 5 miles from the site of next year's Olympic Games. And now, it has spread to two more cities. So Cameron said he's cutting short his vacation in Italy to come back and deal with this problem. Well, that's all I have time to say for this. But I'm learning to discount the way events are described in the news, as this event is described. You know, I know now when I read it, don't necessarily believe it, and certainly don't take it as the way it's being spun, because it can be very, very different from the way it's being spun. So we have to understand the code language they use to cover up the facts or twist the story. An example of this is some new trash that the BBC has come up with. It just appeared yesterday. They're resurrecting a story about the Reverend Hugh Grimes, who was chaplain of Christ Church in Vienna in 1938 when Austria joined the German Reich, an event greeted joyously by all concerned, something that the British intelligence agencies keep trying to spin, but without much success. So now they've turned to a British artist, Christopher Wentworth Stanley, who lives in Vienna and, quote, has been researching this story for many years. Now, this is an artist with a double name, Wentworth Stanley. He might even be an agent. Who knows, you know? But anyway, he has been poring over a bunch of old blue ledgers that belong in this church, which they call, quote, a little piece of England in Austria, unquote, implying in their code language that this church was good England found in evil Austria. He claims that these ledgers contain the names of many Jews baptized there in 1938 with a discernible pattern in the timing, he says. On the 23rd of July, the identity card was introduced with a J on it for Jews. And then he says that, in quoting, on the day after that, 129 people were baptized here. The following day, there were 229. I mean, the church itself only sits 125 people. So he then says, before long, baptism queues were forming down the street outside Christ Church. Now, no one has talked to Reverend Hugh Grimes, whom is no longer alive, about this. But it's assumed that the reason for all this appears to be the hope that baptism certificates would help the city's Jews escape the country. Once Austria and Vienna became part of the German Reich. That's just an assumption, but it seems to sort of pan out. Thus, the BBC, always on the lookout for a British Schindler, is calling Grimes just that, the British Schindler who saved Austrian Jews. That's the title of the news article. They have created a radio documentary on it, which first aired today, and it has already aired. I didn't listen to it, but the BBC was touting Dennis Avey, whom I have written and reported about as a fraud, and they were touting him as the British Oscar Schindler. But maybe they have given up on him because of all the problems with his story, which if you want to read about him and you want to read about what the Labour Party is up to and all of that, you can go to my website, carolynyeager.com, and find those articles. But they're now haven't talked about Dennis Avey for quite some time, but now they've come up with this Reverend Hugh Grimes, and they're calling this man the British Schindler. Notice the initials are BS. Do you think that has any meaning? In order to give the right flavor, they also exaggerate the persecution of the Jews in this article on the day of the day that Hitler entered Vienna. And thousands of Germans lined the streets to cheer him. It was, according to the BBC, quote, the start of terrible times for the country's Jewish population, then one of the largest in Europe, unquote. Yes, there were a lot of Jews in Vienna, and Hitler had remarked on that in Mein Kampf, for any of you who have ever read that. And Hitler spent quite a few years living in Mein Kampf when he was young. I mean, in Vienna when he was young. Sorry about that. But now the article, though, moans, quote, many were beaten in the street and forced to scrub Vienna's pavements, unquote. Now, you know, there's a well-known photograph of some Jews scrubbing the pavement with some soldiers standing around, and a whole lot has been made of that. But what they were scrubbing, which was in investigating this photograph, they had Jews scrubbing not only Jews probably, but citizens were scrubbing not only pavements but walls, which were covered with anti-Nazi slogans that were put there by supporters of the previous regime. And they required, this came from Bridget Heyman, a German Jewish historian. Now, I don't know if it was just the Jews, or rather political opponents who happened to be Jews, many of them, who were doing it. And that's very possible. I don't think they would have just made Jews do it, because what they were scrubbing, what they were cleaning up, were anti-Nazi slogans. So this whole thing, is just propaganda. It's exaggerations. And then this article goes on to add, hundreds of people are thought to have committed suicide. Notice that it says are thought. You see, it didn't say hundreds of people are documented to have committed suicide. No, they're thought. So this is propaganda. Then it goes on to say, quote, Lucian Maisels, now 86, remembers those dark days well. He says, as we walked back home, suddenly the mob was coming in, a howling mob, which I've never seen before, smashing shop windows, just barbaric. That moment we knew we had to get out and had to get out fast, unquote. You know, well, what is he referring to? He says, when we walked back home. Maybe this quote came from some other time. I don't know. But I don't think there was a howling mob at the end of the day that Hitler spoke in Austria. Everybody was very, very happy, and they were celebrating. And when you see, you know, I never read about a howling mob in Vienna. Vienna was a very cosmopolitan place. So it could very well be that these are just pure lies. And when you see stuff like this, don't believe it. When a source is just some old individual remembering. This is an 86-year-old Jew who says, I remember when, you know, this happened. Yeah. No reason to believe such flimsy stuff. But this is just, you know, my attempt to talk about what we need to do when we're reading the stuff that we read. That's all over the news all the time. So let's go back to this New Schindler. The documentary claims, quote, as many as 1,800 Jews had been given baptism certificates before the conversions were finally stopped by an increasingly critical Church of England. Now, why would the church stop it? Well, think of it. This chaplain was handing out memberships in the Christian Church of England to Viennese Jews who didn't believe in Christ or any doctrines of the church. This was a sort of blasphemy and indefensible by the church itself. It was a political act rather than a religious one. Now, I would think that liberals will argue that saving a life excuses this, but it really doesn't. Plus, they didn't know if their lives were in danger. It was 1938. These Jews just wanted the protection of a Christian identity. When the Reverend Grimes returned to England in the summer of 1938, it says that he was told he would not be returning to Vienna. But his replacement at Christ Church, the Reverend Fred Collard, continued to baptize hundreds more Austrian Jews, the article says. But it's not known how much these baptismal papers actually helped most of these Jews who got them. They do not know. They're only talking about what he found in these ledgers that so many people were being baptized at this time. Interestingly, very interestingly, a Jewish historian of the University of London is appalled by what appears to him like a crass recruitment exercise of vulnerable people by a proselytizing church. He says, and quote, any Christians who took advantage of the pressure on Jews to baptize them were doing just that. They were using leverage of the most terrible sort. There were many other ways that members of the Christian clergy could have helped Jews, offering hiding places, false papers, and other kinds of assistance, unquote. I think this is just hilarious. You can't please the Jews. No matter what you say you've done for them, they will find something that is not good enough, and they don't like it. So to this Jewish historian in London, these Christians were taking advantage of these Jews to get them to become Christians. Mm-hmm. This is how this works. So this story is another attempt to create a new Holocaust hero for the British, I would say. It's pretty shaky, but the British government and media have some divisions in them, I think, whose job seems to be to just keep hollow stories coming out. I think the British Liberals and Labour Party are more guilty than the Conservative Party about this, even though Churchill was a member of the Conservatives. I could maybe talk about Churchill a little bit later, but right now I'm going to move on to another branch of this topic about revisionism, and that is that revisionists need help. I want to talk about this right now before I run out of time and I miss it. Do we support our own? Do we support our revisionists? Not very well, because we're very bad at financial support. We have these brilliant scholars who are willing to work for free, but there are still expenses involved that they cannot shoulder. For example, David Irving used to be a Holocaust. Now, before I talk about these revisionists, I'm going to talk about something else. I'm going to talk about a couple of people. The reason why we need to help our revisionists, because they have a lot of work to do. And for example, David Irving, who used to be a Holocaust revisionist, but after he got an early release from the Austrian prison he was in, and believe me, I don't like to talk against David Irving for all the good things he has done, but he kind of changed his tune after that. And he's now insisting that gas chamber extermination did take place, and also mass shootings in the eastern part of Poland and in Russia based on disputed Heffel documents. Now, this is really pronounced Herfel, I guess, Herfle, Herfle, beyond my ability to say properly. But it is spelled, the name is spelled H-O-E-F-L-E. It's that umlaut O. Now, you don't need to know exactly what it is to understand that it's a telegram message to Berlin from an Einsatzgruppen leader giving a figure of 1,274,166 deaths of Jews. I think it's all supposed to be all Jews. It matches the number given by another SS official, Richard Korher, for the number of Jews sent for special treatment in the camps in the general government, meaning occupied Poland, in a report he sent to Himmler a few weeks later, that is a few weeks after this Herflet telegram came, now is dated, I should say. Now, special treatment, you know, never meant extermination. But the Holocausters interpret it that way. See, we're dealing with the code language again. You know, when they saw special treatment, they insisted that meant that these people were, that was the code word for extermination in a gas chamber, or maybe sometimes some other way, but usually that way. But that is not anything that has any reason to believe that, except if you want to account for millions of, Jews being murdered. In this case, we're talking about almost 1.3 million they're talking about here. Now, Irving admits that it could be that. It could be that, unless, of course, a counterfeiter reverse engineered the Heffler document and based his... Well, he admits that it could be authentic, unless he says... that the one is the same as, you know, fits the other. Unless, of course, a counterfeiter reverse engineered the Herfla document based his 7-digit number on the one given in the later Korher report. Because there are many serious problems with the authentication of the Herfla telegram, and therefore this is very likely. In fact, our revisionists say that it is not an authentic document. There are many, many reasons not to think so. And at one time, Irving agreed that it wasn't. But now that he found this other one and something else, he thinks that he's changed his mind back again. All right, I mentioned that there are some other documents have turned up which have caused Irving to now say that the Herfler document is authentic in spite of its problems. And he says My conclusion, I'm quoting from his website, Irving's, my conclusion is therefore that the intercepted Hermann Herfeld signal is an authentic document and that its content has not been reverse engineered from the Corhair report, and that it is a pivotal document in the history of where the real Holocaust operations were taking place, and that this was not at Auschwitz, a site not even mentioned by the Corhair report, incidentally, but in the Reinhardt sites along the Bug River in eastern Poland. Now, another one-time revisionist named Dr. Christian Lintner of Denmark has also done an about-face based on similar ideas as Irving. On him, one of our best published revisioners, Jürgen Graf, author of many books, has written a rebuttal of Lintner's comments, and in this he mentioned that, and I quote, together with two other revisionists, I plan to write a study on the Einsatzgruppen in question. If this project materializes, which is far from certain because it would require a considerable amount of funds, we are still lacking. And he goes on to say some other things. But, and, you know, I knew that they wanted to do this project, and I knew that they didn't have the money for it. But him bringing this up, mentioning it in this rebuttal that he wrote and sent out, and some of you may have seen it. If not, you can write to me, and I'm going to mention that later, and I'll send it to you. But I wrote to Jürgen based on this to find out how much money was needed. And I hope I'm not speaking too much here or out of turn, but I can't understand why it would be, so I'm going to go ahead. I'm determined to see that this money is supplied to them, that they are able to go ahead with this project. So the amount to begin the project is several thousand dollars, which is for transferring the microfilm from the Russian archives onto CDs. Therefore, I am asking my listeners here at VOR to come up with some money for this project. I've already determined an amount that I will be giving. I'm afraid I can't take anything less than about $100 per person, you know, who wants to donate, because I just can't deal with all kinds of little amounts. I don't think, although I might change my mind next week, but I'm really looking for even larger amounts than that so that we can go ahead and get it added up. So I have a PayPal account, which I had to set up because somebody sent me some money. You know, I have never asked for money for myself. I don't have any donation requests on any of my websites. On my personal website, I should say. And I don't really require donations in order to continue my work. But somebody sent me something, and it created a PayPal account for me. So because they sent it in my name to PayPal with my website. So I have one. And perhaps the money that people send to me can be sent there for the time being. You would have to trust me on this. If there's a better way than this, I'm happy to do it. First, though, I would just ask that you send me an email at carolyn@carolynyager.com and tell me how much you can contribute and how you're willing to, which manner in which you're willing to contribute it. And we'll get that worked out. At the same time, if you have not read Jürgen Graf's rebuttal to Christian Lintner, I will forward it to you on request. So, I've been working on this for a little while, writing to some people, but I decided I'm just going to put it out on my program, and maybe I'm wrong to limit it to $100. Maybe if I do have, people can send it to my PayPal account, which is to Carolyn Yeager, based on carolynyeager.com. I guess you could send any amount. Anyway, let me know what you'd like to do on that. I really think that we need to show a willingness, you know, to help out in these matters, because here we have these Jews in control of everything all over the world, putting out their garbage, and we have our wonderful revisionists, the ones we have left, who are still able to work, and they're willing to do the work that we need to have done, but they really need financial support because they don't get any. Not much. And they don't make money on the books, really, either, even though they work so hard writing them. So this is an effort that we just have to do. Now, I'm going to move on in the next half of the program, which is coming up. The break is coming up very soon. I shouldn't miss it this time. I'm going to move on to Humanizing the Holocaust, the title of my program for tonight. I'm going to get in more into what these people are doing, what they're setting up in order to overcome our Holocaust denial or our Holocaust revisionism, which we call it, and somehow they are worried because their story is getting old and tired, and I do believe that more and more people do question it. They might not want to say too much. It's hard for people to go from believing in the whole thing to not believing in the whole thing. So they have to go in stages, and a lot of people are in those stages, and we need to keep moving this along. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I will be back after this important news break and finish the program. Stay tuned.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
So why is this story being so largely ignored by Western media? Well, perhaps here in the U.S., we've had our own suffering economy to talk about. But the implications of what is going on in Israel could be dire. And it's really important for people to understand why what happens there matters here and around the world. Naomi Pace is the Director of Communications for the New Israel Fund and is here in studio to talk about this. Naomi, we saw the journalist in the report we just saw talk about the fact that the only time it's a story largely for Western media is when there's a conflict between Israel and Palestine, Israel and Lebanon. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that?
I think, unfortunately, there is a bias in this country to think of Israel as the locus of conflict. And what's interesting are the endless permutations of the peace process and what is the American government doing and what are the Palestinians saying. Unfortunately, there is a huge story in Israel. This social protest is huge. We're very excited by it. We think it really shows a change within the body politic in Israel in a very desirable way.
Fact that there's 100,000 people on the streets, this is a good thing.
Yes, it is a good thing.
Okay.
Look, these are people who care about the quality of life. It is a middle-class protest, but it is also a protest that crosses political lines, it crosses ethnic lines, it crosses sector lines. Some people say, yes, we know that the left is involved in this protest, but we support it anyway because we care about our future. We care about education. We care about housing. And this is in the face of a government that has been sort of playing, no, don't look at this, look at that man, but don't look at the man behind the curtain. Because basically what they've been dealing out is fear, and they've been dealing out paranoia, and they've been dealing out the idea that, well, the only enemies that Israel really have to fear are the human rights groups, so let's put them out of business, or the people who really are marching for democracy, they're dangerous to Israel, or the people who say, let's boycott settlement goods, let's pass a law against them.
So who then within the country are sort of the people that are also maybe the enemies but not so front and center? Who's causing this strife, this growing gap between the rich and the poor in Israel? I know that last week so many people were protesting housing conditions and housing prices. Who is to blame for all this?
Well, it goes back a long way. First, you should know, Israel has the largest income gap between rich and poor of any developed country, except for the United States, except for us. This is an area in which imitating America is not such a great idea. So there's a lot of reasons why it's happened. There is a sort of imported extreme free market ideology, which is popular and embraced by the Netanyahu government. You have also billions and billions of dollars being spent on settlements and the security.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm talking about Holocaust issues tonight. And I'm going to be talking about this new idea that the Holocaust Education Trust has come up with in Britain, dealing with teachers, to humanize, encouraging them to find ways to humanize the Holocaust. Now, you know, once again, see, we're dealing with the British. The British put a lot of attention on the Holocaust and on keep reminding everyone of the horrors of the Nazis and during World War II and how it was their fault and they're responsible for all these terrible things. Why are they doing this? The British were responsible for some of the most atrocious crimes during World War II and against the Germans. And of course, they don't want attention to be put on that. So they're busy always getting the attention where they want it to go, which is against the Germans or on what they consider to be German crimes, which are mostly invented, totally made up. And now they have this organization that I have written about and talked about even here on this program before in relation to Dennis Avey and the way they promoted his book. And as I already mentioned, these articles that are on my website, you'll also find some of them on Inconvenient History Revisionist blog, a CODO website at revblog.codo.com. But in any event, reviewing the Holocaust Education Trust, it's a British charity considered. It uses the acronym HET. And it's Jewish. It was created by British Jews, and it was founded by Greville Janner. That's the one of the guys. That's the one I wrote about as being a child, a pedophile, and he has been accused by. He was accused by a young man, and there was a big scandal about it, and it's pretty much accepted as truthful, but the man is very powerful, along with other members of government who've been accused of the same thing. But it was founded by Greville Janner and Merlin Rees, both Jews, in 1988, and the aim is to educate young people of every background about the Holocaust and the important lessons to be learned for today. Now, its chairman, as I said, is Janner, and its president is R. Stephen Rubin, also Jewish. And its honorary patrons include the former Archbishop of Canterbury. Now, that's the Church of England going along with all this. Lord Carey, whoever he is. Lord Dolakia, sounds like an Indian person, East Indian. Lord Mackay of Clashfern and Elie Wiesel. How does he get in there with the British? But there he is because he's such a great hero that every country wants him, you know, involved with them in some way. Now, the HET states that one of its earliest achievements, this is what it's so proud of, was ensuring that the Holocaust formed part of the national curriculum for history. Well, that was the reason for forming it in the first place, to make sure that Holocaust was a part of the national curriculum, official, had to be taught. And then after that, it continues to support it and increase it. And this is the same thing that has occurred in the United States, where this Holocaust teaching, which has no reason to be taught in our schools, has more reason to be taught in British schools, actually, none whatsoever in the United States. But it's Jewish organization and Jewish lobbying and Jewish money and all of that combined and that brings it about. So they have managed to pass this in many of our states here in the United States in order to make teaching Holocaust required. And then after that, they work at increasing it into more and more and more time spent, more and more time spent by the students actually just learning about this Holocaust. Now, so now we have this new message here. How to Convey the Holocaust to Teens. And this came out last Tuesday, August 2nd. And they write here, fresh from a visit to Auschwitz-Birkenau, teachers from Furnace College, Barrow, Sandside School, Uiverston, and the Lake School, Troutbeck Bridge, contemplated how to bring the contemporary relevance of the Holocaust into the classroom. See, they know it's tired. They know it's old. They know it doesn't, the students aren't interested. But they want to make it contemporary so they can keep it going. And that's the effort that they're in. And they go all out for it. This goes on. Here's this kind of language. Here's this kind of, code language that's used that that they get people with, although we should know better than to even read these words. With the haunting horrors of the former Nazi concentration and death camps of Auschwitz-Birkenau still at the forefront of their minds, teachers gathered together to discuss how they will present the complexes of the Holocaust and its modern-day messages to young people. And then they say, even more important here, after that, the Holocaust Educational Trust's Lessons from Auschwitz project, and this is a big project that they have, and they get awards for it. They're hobnobbing with the parliamentarians in the British Parliament and so on. You know, they get government money probably for all of this because it's now part of the national curriculum. You know, so the government pays for it. Anyway, this Lessons from Auschwitz project enables teachers to hear firsthand from Auschwitz survivor Leslie Kleinman and then take his emotional story forward with them on a visit to the place where his family was murdered in the gas chambers and where he, quote, fought for his soul. You see how this is an emotion-reeking paragraph here. Everything is about we have to create, we have to bring home the haunting horrors, you know, to these students. We need to make it real. How are we going to do this so we can keep this going? Now, it goes on to say a few paragraphs later, the teachers will now use the experiences of the emotional and challenging visit in their schools. So they're going to increase the emotional part of this story because, you see, we as revisionists come on the basis of facts and reason and rationality and common sense, and they know that, and they're losing that, although you wouldn't know it because they control the media, so all you hear is their side of the story, but they still know it. Even websites like my website, I'm going to give a little plug for that now, why not, just occurred to me, Ellie Weasel Cons the World, which is at www.ellieweaseltattoo.com, in which I have put forth a lot of good articles and information that really silence people like Ken Walzer and others who have come up, you know, against me a little bit, but they don't say a word. They don't, you know, they cannot answer these things, and they know it. So they're coming from this other direction, and we're going to be bombarded with this kind of emotional garbage. And in the next paragraph here, they say that stage three of the trust program brought the 180 teachers from the northern schools back to Manchester. So they sent 180 teachers there. They went back to Manchester to rejoin their small groups and discuss their feelings and how they will convey all this new information to their students. So, this is becoming a science of how to persuade, influence, use psychology on poor, innocent school children and young people. It's not about history. It's not about teaching the history of this period or what actually happened. Not in the least. It's something else, and it's getting more so that way. And do you know of any other period or event in history where teachers try to arouse the emotions of their pupils in this way? Being a teacher and also being a substitute teacher in some public schools and grade schools. I've seen it where it happens to some degree that they teach about the when they teach about the North American Indians in the United States classrooms. Some they do seem to try. They show videos and stuff. That's what they do. They show films, documentaries, which arouse the emotions in some girls. And I've seen it happening, especially mestizo girls will get very angry. And of course, they can be very aggressive and they'll burst out in class against whites and everybody will be very emotional. And it's just terrible. It's just terrible in these classrooms, what, you know, what they're allowing to happen. But back to the British, they say here that as well as the memorialization, it's always been about memorialization. See, it's always been about memory. Oh, we have to keep the memory alive. Well, that's not working so well because they're very worried, too, that the survivors are dying off. And they have a hard sell to sell the children of survivors and the grandchildren of survivors. And they're trying that. You know, they have programs where they're pushing the idea that the children and even the grandchildren have also been traumatized by the things that their survivor parents have said. Or even if they haven't said anything, they have conveyed their memories to them, you know, silently, mentally, and so on. All this garbage, anyway. But that's not enough. So now they're saying the teachers are asked to look at the best ways for their students to rehumanize those murdered and the survivors, whatever that means, to make them more real to them. And the trust, now this is all from the trust, you know, the trust is behind all this. The trust said students should not just see the Jews and the others who were targeted as victims in striped pajamas, but people who once had normality. That is, don't just see them as stereotypes, but try to put yourself in their place, actually. Try to see, you know, how would I feel? What if that was me? And really just get yourself all wrapped up in this stuff which should be left behind and resolved and overcome. But this just brings to mind something which I was going to say, which I've now just forgot, but it'll come back to me. Okay, the educators also point out that some victims were criminals, but how they were treated was morally wrong. Well, you know, many people in these camps were criminals. You know, Germany didn't have too many enclosed prisons. It put everybody in these camps, and so they put their criminals in the camps. If we put our criminals in the United States into camps like that instead of into the prisons we have, we'd see these camps all over the place, and we would see that we weren't any different. But anyway, they say that even though these people were in the camps were criminals, how they were treated was morally wrong. They can only say that because they lie about how they were treated. You know, they say they're all being sent to, you know, sent to their death and so on, which is not true. So it was not morally wrong. This is just another lie or mistaken idea that shouldn't be passed on, but it is. Now, hearing survivor testimonies, it says, is regarded as making understanding of the enormity of the experience more personal. So again, we're back to survivor testimonies. You know, they rely on that. They have given up on any of the factual stuff that these Holocaust historians used to work at in their books. You know, they used to put out these books and they worked at trying to be convincing and that they had evidence for this, that, and the other thing. But they've given that up. I really do believe we won't see much. We won't see any more of that. They're just going to try to get these survivor testimonies to keep hitting people in their emotional self. And they also say photographs are a key way of helping to teach the lessons. Photographs of individuals and groups, making it seem personal. You see real people there, you know, and you say, look at these real people. And imagine what happened to them. This is very similar to what they thought that they could do with those big cases at Auschwitz-Birkenau. Well, they're in Auschwitz, actually, of hair you know, that was taken from the bodies of all these inmates when they were shaved for the prevention of typhus by, you know, getting rid of hair that where lice could hide in. And this big case of old shoes and old suitcases and so on, trying to make hit people in their, you know, where they feel things, make it seem personal. But these photographs of real people, and they say, and especially now they're interested in pre-war pictures that would show people, show the people how they were before they went into the camps. So once again, so that you would look at these pictures and you say, gee, these people are just like you, me, and they're just normal people, and then look what happened to them for no reason, and so on. Moving on down in this article a little bit more, it goes on even to say that the teachers are encouraged to get their students to look at the personal behavior of ordinary people and the terrible choices they made. So, you know, we're all supposed to be suspect because it's just ordinary people who can do things like this. And so we could all do things like this. And we might all do things like this at any moment. Now, this brings up Anders Breivik, who they are not going to let go of for a long, long time. This guy, you know, he is going to be made use of for the propaganda value that he has as a white racist murderer who is dangerous. And he looks just wonderful, looks just like the typical, you know, in fact, even much better than the typical white person. And you never know what can happen. So everybody has to be suspect and under surveillance all the time. Now, this trust has suggested that schools also teach students about the Holocaust perpetrators and humanize them. And they should not assume, now get this, the students should not assume that the Holocaust was merely conducted by the Nazis, but see it as a continental event. There you go. Which relied on the cooperation, collaboration, and acquiescence of many. So, you know, the Jews, again, are not satisfied with blaming the Germans and the Nazis, but they really need to blame now all of Europe. They need to try to get everyone obligated to them forever. They can't tolerate having anybody that opposes them. So this is the way they think they can go about it. Now, remember, this trust that's behind this is completely controlled by Jews. Now, this is what I was going to say earlier that I forgot. All of this Holocaust education in schools, it's all run by Jewish people one way or the other in Jewish groups. I mean, all of it. And therefore, what we have is a situation where our children who are by far not Jewish, they're not Jews, they're only a small amount, very small amount are Jews, indoctrinated into this business, into this Holocaust beliefs, which benefits the Jews and only the Jews, although they pretend like it benefits all of us, you know, but it benefits only the Jews. And they have managed to wiggle their way in there to where they control this. And they're always using the word chilling when they talk about anything to do with Holocaust. In fact, these British newspapers really use it. You know, oh, a chilling image of this and that. You know, the pictures, everything is chilling. Well, this is chilling to me, what I just told you, considering how these Jewish groups are in control of this huge and growing amount of instruction in our schools, and it is really way, way more than it should be. And it starts in the earliest grades and continues. And they've got it in colleges too. You know, and particularly if you're a community college, you know, then they are in control of that. But the regular private colleges just go along because they have so many Jewish donors. So this is just huge, and it's chilling. It is chilling. Now, It says the educational body says a challenging element for teachers and students will be rehumanizing the Nazis to make them seem because we need to realize that they were humans and not monsters. Well, I guess they think this monster business is wearing thin, That's also coming to an end, and that's good because that is due to the work that so many have done and are still doing and that I'm trying to do to teach people to see it differently, and it's making a lot of inroads. There are a lot of people now, even on alternate radio, that are openly speaking well of Hitler and National Socialism, which never happened before. And I really think it started when I started my Heretics Hour program. I broke the ground, but maybe people can point out instances where other people did that. But there probably are on some radio that was, you know. Of course, there's somebody like William Pierce, but I'm thinking more in terms of you know, networks. But anyway, it is growing. It's growing. And so they're saying, well, this is not working. You know, so now we're going to say, well, you know, they were human, and humans are capable of this, and all of these white humans are capable of it. I bet they would never want you to think that Jewish humans are capable of it, just white European humans. Now, they say that, they actually say that they want to teach that the introduction of gas chambers was a method which made killing more humane for the perpetrators. Now, this is what they want to argue, that the Germans chose gas chambers, and they have this thing that's been around for quite a while, that Heinrich Himmler gone and experienced, he saw a bunch of Jews being shot to death. And it upset him so much, he said, there has to be a better way, you know, come up with a better way to do this. This is awful. He's so sensitive that it bothered him. So they came up with the idea of gas chambers. You know, that is so ludicrous. But anyway, that's what they say. Now, I thought I was going to have too much time, but now I see I've got 5 minutes left. So let me finish up here. While at Auschwitz, Barry, this is the same teachers who were there, Rabbi Barry Marcus asked the teachers to spread the message among young people of not fearing difference. Well, of course, they're there talking to all these rabbis and Jews and everything who were, they just about are devote, you know, bow down to these people. And that's their message all the time. Don't fear difference. Don't fear difference. You know, don't be a bigot. Don't be xenophobic. Then you'll end up killing people. Well, look at these riots in London and in Birmingham now, and now it's spread to Liverpool. And now you know who's doing this? People who are different from the British people. The British people wouldn't be burning up their own cities and doing this. And so having all these different people leads to this. But oh no. We're not supposed to think about that. Mr. Kleinman, who is the one who's telling his experience as a survivor, told the teachers that when he was a youngster, he was beaten up by others because he was Jewish. And that was before he was taken away to Auschwitz. Now, he could just make this up. Who knows if he was beaten up because he was Jewish? You know, if people aren't sick of hearing about what happened to Jews, I don't know, but I do think they are. However, they're trying to get around this. Now, Karen Turner, learning enrichment coordinator at Furness College, who is a part of this group, said she thinks it would be useful for students to consider the murder of Sophie Lancaster. She says the 20-year-old, or somebody, they wrote here, that the 20-year-old was kicked to death in a park in Lancashire in 2007 because she was a goth. See, so this is the method, the message, you know. People are who are different. Now, being a goth is one thing, but this would also include being homosexual, being a transvestite, being this or that. If other people don't like it, they're going to do these terrible things to you, and we have to stop this. So we must accept everybody and all their differences into our world. The rest of I don't have anything much marked in the rest of this article. It just goes on and on with these people giving their suggestions, but not very interesting. But that is that's the future. That's what they're working at. And I also want to tell you that this Holocaust Education Trust in Britain is a really evil organization, And they are responsible for the British Hero of the Holocaust Award, which has been given posthumously to many, many people, 20 or 30 or something, and Dennis Avey included, who is not a hero. But this was dreamed up for Gordon Brown, who was the previous prime minister before the... All right, and it was, though, it was created by the Holocaust Education Trust. This was one of their bright ideas. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening to the program tonight. Please come back next week for another Holocaust.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.